Hello, everyone, and welcome to Coast to Cast, the podcast on coastal science, where we meet scientists and ask questions that don't usually appear in published papers. My name is Giovanni, and today I have the incredible pleasure of chatting with Professor Gerben Roesink from University of Utrecht. Gerben and I have met a long time ago. We don't need to say how many years ago, but it was a long, long time ago. And I was very lucky because I was a PhD student, and Gerben was the star of sandbar morphodynamics. And I was very lucky because Gerben spent a lot of time with me, explaining me about bars and telling me about sandbars, when they become crescentic, how do you detect the sandbar, a lot of basic stuff that I actually didn't know. That was great because it developed a friendship that has lasted over the years. Every time we had the chance, we would get together, visiting each other, keeping up with our kids as they were growing. But then little by little, Gerben has changed field, has moved from nearshore study to aeolian research. Now, it might seem like it's not a big change, but the reality is that there are two different communities. Somehow we ended up losing touch, and so I'm really, really happy that today I can spend some time chatting with him. Hello, Gerben. Welcome to Coast to Cast, and thanks for taking the time to join and answer some questions.
Hi, Giovanni. Yeah, thanks for the introduction. It's really a pleasure, and it's excellent that we can talk. Yeah, it's been a while that we last spoke. COVID didn't help in that sense, but yeah, really good to be here.
So let's start with COVID. Has COVID affected your research and how?
Yeah, I think there are positive changes and negative effects. For example, that there's now the possibility of using Teams and Zoom, and we can speak. I don't have to fly half the world to go to a conference for a 10-minute presentation. That's all been accelerated, I would say, by COVID. On the other hand, I cannot deny that the lockdowns and we couldn't do any field work. And especially, I think it was after the second lockdown, when we were sort of a year or so into the COVID period, I sort of lost the difference between, I was always at home. We had to work from home, and my personal life is at home. That was a really stressful period. And thanks to a colleague actually at work who sort of realized I was sort of a little bit struggling, I got permission to work in the office. The office was basically only accessible if you really didn't have a place at home to work. So I was allowed back into the office and sort of separate personal from work life. And that was really, when things got much better again. And that was sort of the survival, I would say, sort of mentally. It was, that was a really tough period. But now everything is sort of back to normal. And fieldworks are commencing again. I can see my students. So that was also very difficult. There's a whole generation of students who I've only seen as little initials in team boxes that I've never seen in real life. And that is really, even my master's students, some of them I saw for the first time during their graduation just a couple of months ago. And that was really, really weird. And I hope that's going to be avoided in the next couple of years.
Yeah, I think the mental toll of those lockdowns has been quite incredible. And I think PhD students are probably the ones that have suffered the most. Yes.
Yeah, they were allowed in our situation in Utrecht, they were allowed pretty soon back into the office, despite the official work from home message. So that was pretty clear. Of course, I have a good working place at home, but still the difference between the personal life and the work life all happening in exactly the same spot, that was sort of mentally rather difficult.
Yeah. I can imagine. Let's start with our usual questions. And the first one is about how did you start in coastal science?
That's a good question. And I sort of struggle with the answer in the sense that I've never been somebody who as a kid went to the beach or enjoyed dunes or loved sailing or surfing or so. When I was a kid, I loved plants and I loved animals and especially birds. So I always wanted to study biology. And at some point, I started to collect minerals and fossils. So then geology came into the spotlight. And when I actually went to university on an information day, I stumbled across physical geography. I still don't know why I entered that room. There was no plan or so, but I just went there. And I was captivated immediately. It was something about the Earth's surface, from the mountains and glaciers and deserts and coasts and rivers. And I thought that is much more interesting than geology, actually. And I started doing that. And I think it were lectures by Joost de Wint and Leo van Rijn. Hey, you also know Leo. And also Art Kroon, who's now in Copenhagen. That made me decide to go to do the coastal stuff. It was coastal dynamics was also the course actually for which I had the lowest mark during my entire student career. So that made me want to understand it better. And then Art Kroon had this wonderful, we would now say master topic for graduation. Doing measurements. It was in the late 1980s, so that is sort of really pioneering stuff on measuring and the breaking waves. And that was I found it so fascinating. Yeah, it never left. And coastal science, that's the sort of where it started. No plan, it just sort of happened as the study went along.
Entering the wrong room at the wrong time.
Yeah, that's sort of the how I got to physical geography.
So you mentioned it already, the importance of balancing personal life and work life. How do you do that?
It's sometimes fairly straight easy, and or I find it like that, and sometimes I really struggle. For me, it's very important that at some point, say 5 in the afternoon, I can and close the door, leave the PC, and then go home. It's really the separation between where I work and where I live and so on with the family. Yeah, the difficult spots come at the moment that it's really busy when you have to prepare the teaching and when there's this big grant that needs to be written and there's a big deadline. And yeah, then suddenly you're almost impossible to avoid working at home. And that's where the danger for me, it sort of starts. I'm getting better at it. I'm also more and more learning to say no, to not do everything. Also to master students and to PhD students, sometimes you simply have to say no. I think it's better to say no than to say, okay, I'll do it next week. And then you don't do it and you postpone it for another week and another week. In the end, it doesn't happen. I think it's better to be clear from the beginning. And I have also sort of started to realize that many people are just very happy if you say no, because then they can sort of look for other help, so that's that they don't wait that much. But yeah, it's something that I need to watch very carefully. That's what I've definitely learned over the years. Yeah,
I think we all struggle with it. What are your interests out of work?
Oh. Actually, it's a bit related to the previous question. I usually take to balance work and private life. It's very important for me that every sort of 3 weeks or 4 weeks or so, I do take a day off. I'm going out for hiking, long distance path, just a day, but then I continue the next time. So hiking is really one of my favorite hobbies. And I have a big kitchen garden, so gardening. That also takes, especially in the weekends, it takes a lot of time. But it's really just like the hiking. I can sort of switch off and relax and get my head empty and enjoy. And sometimes alone, sometimes with the wife and children. Yeah, that's really important to me.
So you have a very interesting story, in fact. We met when you started working on nearshore processes, sandbars, longshore current. You led the large European experiments. You collaborated with the best scientists worldwide. And you were really the star of nearshore morphodynamics, but then all of a sudden you decided to move to alien research. Why and how did you find the change?
Perhaps it's somewhat surprising, but you have a little bit to do with it, actually. In sort of 2013, I gave a keynote at a conference you organized. It was RCEM, and that same about a month later, I also gave a keynote at Coastal Dynamics. And that meant two things for me. First of all, it made me really realize that people consider me the expert on this nearshore sandbar stuff. And actually somebody in the audience at some point called me Mr. Sandbar. And on that's really cool. But at the same time, it also made me realize, do I want to stay Mr. Sandbar for the next sort of 10, 20 years? Perhaps it's time to move on and to do something else. And these keynotes also, I wanted part of the keynotes to be about, what are the big challenges? What's next? And then I sort of realized that, there's more than nearshore. The nearshore is coupled to the coastal dunes, and the dunes are aeolian, and there's vegetation, and there's more. Yeah, usually we talk about erosive stuff, and aeolian is accretive. I was also sort of, as you said, surprised that it were sort of two different communities. And nearshore people stop at the high tide line or at the dune when there's erosion, and then there's absolutely nothing. And then 5 meters further, the aeolian people start, and they don't go to the same conferences. Yeah, it's much better now, luckily. But at the time, they were really separate worlds. And that also sort of intrigued me. As I thought there was, the big challenges for aeolian people, part of the answers could come from the nearshore morphologist and also the other way around. And that sort of made me realize, okay, perhaps there are two different fields, but they are related to some degree. And I really enjoyed the move. I haven't lost complete contact with the nearshore stuff. We still do a lot of it in my research group, and I'm still supervising PhD students on it. But I'm not sort of the first contact. There's other people doing that. And there's this big new second research line on aeolian dynamics. And I also like it that you can actually see aeolian sand transport. The Dutch waters are really murky. And you study sand transport, but you can never see it. Yeah. Whereas aeolian sandport is very visible. And that's also really nice.
So you've been part of two communities overall, the nearshore one and the aeolian one. With respect to the nearshore one, what do you think we could do to improve our community?
A big change that is going to happen and that needs to happen is that we move completely to open science. There's a lot going on already with open access publications and open data and open software, and but I think it will need to become much more open. Sometimes when I talk to colleagues about this, they're sometimes a bit hesitant about opening up data sets because they're afraid they're getting scooped or so, or somebody else is doing something with the data, or a bug is discovered in the code or whatever. But I think, perhaps a bit naive, but I think there's much more to gain from cooperation than to be lost by competition. So I'm really a big fan of this open science development. And I'm very pleased that it is already happening, but I think it can be much, much stronger, actually, and much more.
So as you know, we mix questions, science and non-science. Let's go to one of my favorite science questions. Tell us about the paper you like the most or a paper that changed your science.
I think it when I we just discussed that I switched from the nearshore to the aeolian world, I think the paper that affected me at the time the most was the fetch effect paper by Bauer and Greenwood, and they discussed how in a very simple, elegant way how you could go from this very complicated sand transport that perhaps hardly anybody understands how it works, to more, say, longer term growth of June. So that's aggregating over all this complicated stuff, you can still predict June growth. So it's a skill bridging paper. And that's also perhaps because of my training as a physical geography that I find fascinating, how you can go from, say, seconds to years and how you deal with that. The paper was out, and I think the first paper that actually built on this was 10 years later or so by Irene Delgado, who actually turned it into a more operational model. And I sort of expanded on that also, actually quite a lot. Yes, but all the basic ideas were already there. Sort of 20 years ago, there were already people said, well, you should do it like this. And finally, sort of 20, 25 years later, okay, now we finally managed to sort of get the understanding to a sort of a sufficient level that you can actually use it for operational predictions.
Tell us and maybe explain briefly one of the topic of research that particularly excites you at the moment.
What I find very important in my research is that it is connected to society relevant questions, that it can also be applied, that it's connected to coastal zone managers or nature managers. What I work on especially nowadays is coastal dunes. They've always been sort of looked at only from a safety perspective, preventing marine flooding. And in the Dutch case, that often meant that it was planting by marram grass and it made higher and taller and densely vegetated. And over the last sort of 10 years, we've come to realize that it might be very safe now, but it is also completely blocking the sediment exchange from the beach and the more landward dunes. That's like a dike. On the long term, these dunes do not get the sediment to grow with sea level rise or to expand laterally in the landward direction. So nowadays, dunes are being opened up. So the dike, there are actually people build gaps in them, like blowouts, equivalents of natural blowouts. It's really a different way of thinking. And these blowouts, this sediment, are also believed to be beneficial for biodiversity, because locally, the new sand covers the vegetation and opens up opportunities for new pioneer species. So you have a very mosaic-like landscape, patches with very mature vegetation and patches with pioneer species. That actually also links back to the biology that I talked about in the beginning, that I wanted to become a biologist. So most of my work is actually the biogeomorphology of these sort of restored coastal dune systems, from the plant level to the landscape level. That's sort of where I see myself working now and where I hope to continue at least for the next 5 or 10 years. Although I do not have the ambition to become Mr. Fortune or so.
You do a lot of field experiments. Tell us about the wildest field conditions you encountered.
Yeah, that is actually in one of these gaps that I just mentioned. So there was this big storm. Wind speeds were 20 meters per second or so. So that's quite tough. There's a lot of aeolian activity. And the sediment actually was blown through this gap onto these more landward dunes. And in this gap, the wind is enormously accelerated. It goes from 20 to 25 to 30 meters per second, just a few decimeters above the bed. And this sand was propelled into the air when it left this gap, and it then rained down over these dunes. And these are called the smoking dunes. So it's horrible to be inside because you get completely sandblasted, and it takes days to get the sand away from you. Sand is everywhere, and that's so enormously fascinating. These smoking dunes. Yeah, it's also the most dangerous to equipment, I can assure you.
What about the strangest thing you've seen on a beach or on a dune?
Or on a dune, yeah. Stuff that doesn't belong there. When I'm in a beach, I'm still, it's perhaps not so strange. It's actually quite common, but it still puzzles me why it happens. There's so much rubbish on the beach, so much plastic and nets and garbage and light bulbs and refrigerators and all sort of stuff that washes ashore. That I always puzzled up, who on earth would want to throw it away? Huh? Why is this light bulb there? What's the where it's coming from? It actually it puzzles me, but it also saddens me that there is so much rubbish out in the place that we love most, actually. So I don't know how that works in the New Zealand case or so, where there's still a lot of rubbish floating on the beach. But in the Dutch case, there's quite a lot of plastic that ends up on the beach.
I think we're a bit lucky here. There is not a lot of people in New Zealand, and the beaches here are pretty amazing, I have to say. It's a wonderful place.
Keep it like that.
Absolutely. You've always been very careful to innovations, very interested at innovations and latest techniques. What's your take on machine learning?
I think it's could become one of sort of the core disciplines in handling this explosion of data that we are now witnessing. Of course, we talk a lot about daily satellite observations and long time series and stuff that you can see, and also equipment that measures. I have equipment out in dunes that measure at 10 hertz, and they do that at 10 places, and already for 6 years, the data sets are incredibly large. Yeah, as you know, when I studied sandbars, I did play a little bit with neural networks. Yeah? Perhaps you remember my PhD student, Leo Pape. This was big fun. But yeah, by now one would call these neural networks probably shallow learning, because they only had one or two layers, and we're now into deep learning. I actually had a master's student earlier this year who worked on drone images from coastal dunes, and she actually used this recurrent neural networks to sort of map habitats from these drone images. So not just say this is sand or vegetation, but this is sort of this type of vegetation. And because there are time series of these drone images, you can actually start to see how habitats are evolving with time. And of course, you can do that manually, but that's a hell of a job and way too much time. But with this machine learning, this is really big opportunities, I would say.
Can you predict a major advance to happen in the next 15 years in coastal science? I know this is a bit of a crazy question, but let's hear from you.
Sort of asking me to sort of to predict the unknown, but I think there are two things, actually. I would really hoping that we can see the coast more as a bigger system, not just the near shore, but also include the dunes and tidal inlets and spits, or when we go more to a tide dominated area with tidal flats or wetlands or whatever, that it makes for a much bigger system. And the other thing is really the biogeomorphology, that we move from, say, a single species perhaps more to sort of ecosystem modeling, where you can model how ecosystems and landscapes evolve together. And there's a lot of work already being done on that, but I'm really hoping that there's somebody there to say, ching, and that there suddenly is this big new modeling approach or understanding that opens up an entire new field. That's sort of what I'm dreaming of. Don't think I'll be able to do that, but if somebody in the next 10, 20 or 30 years is going to make a breakthrough, I really think it's sort of about this larger scale and this integration of the physical and the biotic components.
What about the best or worst advice you ever received?
Oh, a lot of people gave me very good advice, and they made me what I am today. Also, when we talked about this personal and work life, it is how much advice I got about time management and keeping track of all the tasks I do. And that's true. I hate to be surprised by something I had to do, but I forgot to do, or completely forgot about that I had to do it. The worst advice perhaps it's not so much advice, but it's more an attitude. At least for a long time, I had the impression that you could only become a good scientist if you wrote a lot of papers, had big career grants, so were mostly successful on your own. It was more sort of like a personal track. And I've seen many students, but also PhD students sort of struggle with that. If you want to do it like that, perfect. But I've also seen people struggle with it, or they get demotivated, thinking like, if that's the only way I can become successful, that's not for me. And I've seen people leave university for a negative reason. That they thought, well, that's not the science for me. That's not the way it should be done. And luckily, at least in Utrecht, but I think more globally also, we're moving more towards the appreciation of teamwork, bigger teams, that everybody has his own very strong role inside a team. The focus on impact, on society relevant stuff, and not to forget teaching. And there's a lot of different ways you can actually be a scientist. If I look back on my own career, I've of course been grown up in this paper writing and grant writing, and I have a lot to thank for it. But if I really look back, perhaps I should have enjoyed more at certain moments. If you know what I mean, it's sometimes it was too output focused, I would say, and almost forgot, that science can also be fun. And that you can also have a lot of fun without writing a paper.
To conclude, I have another question, and I'm a little bit curious to hear your thoughts. Over the past decade, there has been a lot of interest in the nearshore, trying to model shoreline dynamic, shoreline position.
Yeah.
And we try to model extremely long temporal horizons, like the end of this century. And there are obviously many uncertainties. What do you think is the value of those predictions? Are they useful?
Ooh, I think it depends on how you ask the question. If you think it is as a deterministic prediction, can you tell me in 2100 where the coastline will be exactly at this position? I would say no. Of course, you can give a certain uncertainty to it. I think the big value in these sort of predictions lies primarily in a more exploratory way, in looking at scenarios. What would happen if sea level rise would be this? What would happen if the wave climate would change? What could be the consequences of that? I think there's the main strength of this longer term prediction. So not precisely in, okay, it will be here, but more in where would it be if it had been different conditions, and what can we learn from that? I think that's the main value of such predictions.
Great answer. Unfortunately, we're rapidly approaching the end of the show. We have now some very quick questions. Tell us about your favorite band, music, or composer.
During COVID times, I listened a lot to classical music, and I discovered this composer from Estonia called Ervo Part. When I heard his Spiegel im Spiegel for the first time, I was completely blown away. I mean, it's just two instruments, a few notes, very simple, you would say, but the music is so complicated and so beautiful. It sometimes reminds me of numerical models, where it's very simple principles, you can make very complicated patterns. And that's also like that music. So that's definitely my present day favorite composer.
Favorite dish?
That must be noodles with vegetables and tofu.
Latest book you read?
Well, we're just back from holiday, so that's probably the Tourist Guide to Paris. But on a more serious note, I'm currently reading a book from Murakami. He's one of my favorite authors, and he published a new book in 2021, which I completely missed for some reason, but just got a copy, and that's where I'm going at now.
And do you have a favorite movie?
Not really. There are so many movies that are fun. If you had asked me what is the most recent movie that I watched, I would have said it's The Minions, The Rise of Gru, which I just watched yesterday. And yeah, my kids are always making fun of it because my initials, Gerben Lussink, are also Gru. And one of the secretaries actually at some point called me Gru. So that is definitely, a fun one.
Okay, thanks a lot, Gerben. And it's been fantastic to hear from you. Thanks a lot for taking the time to join us. And thanks a lot to all our listeners. Bye, Gerben, and bye to our listeners.